Hey, everybody out there. This is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David. Live streaming interviews with folks most weekday mornings, usually Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. And you can be wherever you're viewing this. It might be on the Facebook page of Popular Resistance or the Facebook page of KABU Community Radio or my own Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn, VK, Twitch. I'm missing something. Facebook, I don't know. What did I miss? A bunch of different platforms. Anyway, it's goes out live and then in podcast form afterwards if you look for This Week with David Rovics wherever you get your podcasts. And today I'm very happy to be spending the hour with one of the most amazing musicians and organizers that I've ever known, who is from Chicago, Illinois, Chris and Sarah, who, if you've ever been to a School of the Americas protest, then you have, whether you know it or not, you have witnessed her handiwork as both an organizer and a musician. And with no further ado, I'm just going to bring Chris and Sarah onto the program. Chris, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, David.
And I haven't seen you, as we noted, we haven't seen each other for a long time, but that's true for so many people that for me, as a formerly touring musician, when I was, not to go into a long story here, but I mostly, my touring is in Europe for a long time now because I can't make any money touring in the U.S. The way that these things work. And,
right.
And so basically I haven't seen a lot of people in the U.S. for a long time, but also, the protests that you've been very much involved with in Georgia kind of moved to the border, and I haven't made it to those. But I just think that, and I have told many people over many years in many different forms, looking it up and in writing as well, that me and Joe Jenks have both bragged about your talents on essays, I notice, when I was looking you up online. But the protests in Georgia at the School of the Americas were, I think, Pete Seeger referred to them as the singingest protests he had ever seen. And I most definitely agree. And I was going to ask you other questions, but I never know where to start. But
clarification, what Pete Seeger said was the SOA Watch movement is the singingest movement since the Civil Rights Movement.
Oh, that's a good clarification. Yes. Yeah. And it's also very accurate. I mean, and how musical the Civil Rights Movement was, and everybody associates music with the movement. And that's not many movements are like that, but that's so true of the movement, the protests outside the SOA.
Yeah.
And I mean, well, just diving right into this subject, I mean, I go to so many protests, and for so many years, my entire adult life, and most of them are characterized by a tragic lack of any cultural elements, and just one boring rant after another. And even the speakers, I think, like, gosh, can you just tell a story instead of telling us what you think and what you feel? Like, tell us a story and illustrate your point. It'll come across so much better. But there's such a lack of music, and that's so not with the SOA protests. They're just so full of music. And first of all, I'm just wondering, how did that happen in the first place? I'm pretty sure you were on the ground floor of those protests in the early 90s.
Yeah, so there, I would add, in addition to music, the arts, so the visual arts and the puppetistas.
Yes,
they have become a part of the movement both in Georgia and at the border. So on November 16th of 1989 was the yet one more horrific massacre in El Salvador. That was the massacre of the 6 Jesuit priests and Elba and Selena, their housekeeper and daughter. And so the murder, that horrific murder, became very, very prominent in the media. And 1 year later, 13 people, including then Marianne priest Roy Bourgeois and Kathy Kelly, who's a Chicagoan, a colleague and dear friend of mine, who's a 3-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee, and 11 others. There were 13 of them. And they held a vigil, a fast, outside of the Army base. So in Fort Benning, Georgia, about an hour and a half from Atlanta, is the Fort Benning Army base. And deep in the woods, it's this gorgeous facade of beauty. But deep in those woods of the Fort Benning Army Base is the School of the Americas, which we call the School of the Assassins. Used to be in Panama. It moved to Georgia. And so that vigil in 1990, that first vigil, was just 13 people. I was not a part of it then. I wasn't a part of it for a few more years. Each year, more and more people started to come and gather to mark the anniversary of November 16th. And not just the massacre, it's called the UCA massacre, the University in El Salvador, but the El Mazote massacre in El Salvador, 900 people in one day. The murder of the four North American church women, the murder of Archbishop Romero in El Salvador, all of those murders and massacres are due to the training at the School of the Americas, a U.S. military training facility, and training Latin American soldiers how to brutalize their own people in the name of democracy, right? And so each year it got bigger and bigger. And a few years after, I'm going to say, it's hard for me to remember because it's been so many years, but I think I time it by the age of my children. So my oldest is...
I measure everything that way too. Yeah, it's right. Always the easy dates to remember.
My oldest is 27, and I believe that he was four and my one-year-old came down. So 25 years ago, I got asked by Charles Carney, another Chicagoan. People said, if each of us, there were about 600 people the year before, if each of us asked 10 people, you know, and half of them come, we can have thousands down here. So the first year that I came about 25 years ago, there were about 2,000 people. And then each year it was getting bigger and bigger and bigger until we did at our peak in Georgia, we got to about 15,000 people gathered outside that army base, and people being willing to not only gather and protest and organize and sing and educate each other, but people willing to risk arrest. So crossing the line onto that army base meant that you were facing 6 months in prison for carrying, if you look behind me, these are beautiful. This is Glenda, 9, and Rosada, 11. Hmm. And these two beautiful girls from Guatemala, their mother, Adriana, who is a beloved friend of mine and a survivor of the violence in Guatemala, and because of the School of the Americas, on September 11th, right? 1981. Hmm. A different September 11th, they were disappeared along with her father and her stepmother and Alma, her 1.5-year-old baby sister. And so as we call out presente, we say, Glenda, 9 years old. And the thousands gathered, presente.
And Rosada, that is so powerful.
11 years old. Presente. So we would, that very first year that I was there, there were a lot of people risking arrest. And the leadership, Roy Bourgeois, Carol Richardson, they said, you know what, we're going to cross the line. Can you just keep singing names? And they gave me a bunch of names. I had not been there before. This was my first year. I wasn't doing a lot of singing. I was just kind of gathered and supporting people, you know, honored and humbled to be a part of this collective. And they gave me this list of names the night before and said, it's just da 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 da. And I'm like, okay.
So I guess. Is that melody a Catholic chant of some kind, or where'd that come from?
Yes, it came from a friend, and I have his beautiful face in my head, but my aging brain is not, I'll remember his name, from DC. He had been there the year before and he had started that. It is kind of a Catholic mantra chant. Mm-hmm. Of the saints that Catholics would often do in the during certain services. So
it's just kind of like they threw you this pile of names and then you just started doing it there on the spot. And exactly. And then did crowd start joining in?
Yeah, I'm remembering his name, John. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I thought I would be doing it for, you know, a little bit of time. And it
takes a long time to get arrested.
Well, sometimes. What happened is that year, so many hundreds of people went into the woods and they didn't arrest them right away. They allowed them to walk further and further into the woods. I was standing on a chair at a podium with a microphone. That was the stage that year. And I was singing the names, and then I was singing the names, and then I was singing the names. It probably went on for a good hour. And it just, you know, they had allowed people to go further in the woods. Everybody who was gathered on this side of the line wanted to just keep that presence until we heard from them. And everyone's voices were just echoing through the trees and the forest. It was really profound. It was really powerful to hold that ground sacred through those presentes with everybody gathered as we honored and remembered the horror and the evil because of U.S. military training in Latin America. So that continued. As I said, it got bigger and bigger. It started as a kind of a Catholic nuns and priests gathering of people, and it became more and more diverse age-wise. It still was predominantly white, and the leadership was predominantly white, and that white privilege started to get challenged by younger, more diverse organizers and directly impacted people. People saying, hey, what you're doing is great, but you haven't survived torture. You don't have a loved one who has died or has disappeared. You need to listen to us. And actually, Adriana, the mother of Glenda and Rosara, was one of those people that we invited into the circle, into a part of the leadership to challenge us, to figure out how to be more responsive to these voices and these calls and these demands that were coming. So we went through some healthy, challenging years of reorganizing and regrouping, and the staff becoming more diversified and being directly impacted people as well, and a younger leadership. And then, as you said, in 2016, because of everything going on at the border, because things are so horrific, and that isn't, you know, it isn't to say what's happening now, which is beyond horrific. We said, you know what, we need to be at the border. And our staff had started to move. Because we couldn't shut down the SOA, we came very close. So we came very close about 10 years ago, and we came within a handful of votes in Congress. So they woke up and said, uh-oh, these people are having an effect. They might literally shut down this school. So 4 months later, in December of the following year, and I'm not recalling the exact year, but it reopened. It closed. And then 4 months later, we celebrated, we closed it down, knowing that something else was going to come. And they
the Western Hemispheric Institute for Security Cooperation. WISC. WISC. Yeah. Isn't it WISC? Doesn't it?
It's WINSEC.
So WINSEC. Okay.
WINSEC. We continue to call it the SOA because we call it the School of Assassins. So all they did was add one human rights course, and they changed a couple things. The same school, the same shame. And so we've continued to organize, but because we couldn't get a grip in Congress now with the new name, you know, we have even some of our strongest congressional backers were, well, you have to give it a chance. It's like, no, people are dying and being tortured and killed right now. And we, SOA Watch, was documenting who was being trained, the massacres and killings and oppression that was happening, and who was responsible. So we were the ones to keep unearthing those names and the connection to this SOA, which actually WINSEC SOA is only one of many. There's it's that Pandora's box, that octopus that keeps growing more arms and heads and is in way too many places. So we have also needed to, part of moving to the border was naming that the evil was spreading. And actually, we had learned that U.S. Border Patrol were being trained at the SOA in Georgia. Mm. And so we needed to go to the border. We needed to name that evil. And so we did in 2016. And we called it was the first binational encuentro, so the gathering. We literally on both sides of the border. We had a pickup truck on the U.S. side because we didn't have a permit, and people who organized there and did a lot of work said, we do not want to get a permit because then we will always have to get a permit. So we needed to respect and work. We had staff go down there months ahead of time to start working with local people. So we weren't going to helicopter in and be this group that did this thing and left, but that we could start developing roots and relationships and collaboration with local people who were doing this work every day and had been doing it for years, directly impacted people. And then you have that wall. And on the Mexico side, we had a huge stage. We had the huge sound system. And that, you know, and we could face each other through the slats, right, of the wall to have a binational gathering, an encuentro. And so we were there.
Were there sound systems on both sides of the wall? Was that how it set stages on both sides?
Well, we had microphones on the U.S. side and that were connected to the sound system on the Mexico side.
Fantastic. Right.
So we had people on the back of the pickup truck with everybody who didn't feel that they could cross, chose to stay on the U.S. side. And then myself and many others, we were on the Mexico side and, you know, so many local people. An example is it's another person I keep close to my work and living space. This is Jose Antonio. So Jose Antonio, 16 years old, and he was killed by U.S. Border Patrol. He was on the Mexico side, and his family, just like so many of the indigenous people and Mexican folk, their families were on both sides. And when the wall went up, their families were separated, and some of them could cross and some of them couldn't cross. Well, he was on the, he had family on both sides. He was on the Mexico side. Now you have to understand, he's down and the wall on the Mexico side, there's a huge cement incline that goes way up, hundreds of feet up to the top where the wall is. He was at the bottom, way down at the bottom. And there were some other youth there, and somebody was throwing stones hundreds of feet up against a metal wall separating the two countries. U.S. Border Patrol on the U.S. side shot down and killed him, 16 years old. So the connection between the U.S. Border Patrol and the SOA, and the reason why historically why are people coming? People aren't going through the desert and risking dying and kidnapping and all of the horror that it takes to leave Honduras or Colombia or Chile or Venezuela or Mexico, Guatemala, and to come and to try to come to the United States, which historically had a sense of welcoming. At least you could enter and ask for asylum. You cannot do that now. Under this past administration, you cannot even enter and ask for asylum. You have to wait in a third country. So there's, you know, the policies and the declarations that have come down have just devastated, not only devastated lives, but before you, I joined this with you, I am working on for November 21st and 22nd. That's the annual vigil weekend, right? We always gather. In 2016, 17, and 18, we stayed at the border. In fact, we had staff move to the border. Our office, our main office, is no longer in D.C. It's at the border, right? Oh, so great. That we can work with the directly impacted people. But, you know, our gathering, so that was 2018, 2019, we went back to Georgia because it was 30 years. 1989 was the massacre. So 30 years, we decided, you know what, we're going back to Georgia. And a lot of people came from the border. Jose Antonio's mother and grandmother came from the Mexico-Arizona border and came to Georgia. They saw the origins of this organizing. People from the border, some people from Latin America, people from the U.S. We gathered in Georgia last year. This year, we're gathering virtually. We're gathering on November 21st to have a day of workshops and learning and educating with people from both sides of the border. And on Sunday the 22nd at 1:30 Central Time, we will have the vigil. We will have
and
the
that's, I guess, at soaw.org.
That is right, soaw.org. The registration link will be up soon. The promotion for it is up there. There just isn't a registration link yet, but we will gather. We will sing. In fact, a lot of musicians that you know who have been a part of SOA Watch for a long time will be. I just had a meeting Monday. We had an organizing meeting. We were figuring out the music over Zoom so that there could be music. Some of it's going to be pre-recorded and most of it's going to be live, but it'll be a part of the gathering on Sunday, November 22nd. At 1:30 Central Time. We will have the litany, which names the evils in each of the countries. There's a sung response. We will be singing the names I'm inputting 197 names right now, just since January, of people who have died in the desert just at the Arizona-Mexico border. That is one location. We will sing those names. Most of them are unidentified, and they're bones because they weren't found for a long time. We will sing the names of people recently who have been killed in Latin America. We will sing the names of children who have died in detention centers because of U.S. policy here. And we will sing some of the infamous names of Selena and Elba and the Jesuits and Oscar Romero and the North American churchwoman and the El Mazote massacre.
So that's have the protests at the border have been organized along the similar lines in terms of the format? I mean, the background of the SOA and its reason for existing as a torture school and our imperial foreign policy and the deaths at the border. I mean, this is all obviously very extremely relevant stuff. And it's this kind of thing that I'm talking about a lot on this show with people. But right. the nature of the protests that as theater I love the organization and everything that you guys are doing. But I mean, in terms of the theatrical aspect, is what as a musician I'm especially taken by. And I mean, having traveled around Latin America to some extent, it's that's one of the things that's so evident of the protests there, how full of music they are, and how central, you know, Silvio Rodriguez and Nueva Canción and salsa and so many other things are to the hearts of so many people throughout, from Mexico to Argentina. I mean, the flavors vary wildly, but the right. music is so much everywhere, and that's less the case in many of the countries that I spend most of my time in, like North America and Europe. You know, there's less of a understanding of the role that music and art can play in affecting people, their hearts and their minds. And I think anybody who has not been to one of these protests, it's hard to, well, I mean, it's impossible to communicate how much of a deeply emotional experience it is to hear people and to participate in the singing of the names of the hundreds and thousands of names over the course of much of a Sunday while people are getting arrested in Georgia, but just with or without people getting arrested while this is going on, just and I'm sure you would agree that it's not the same as just reading out the names. It's the fact that you're singing them that is why it's also having so much more of an emotional impact. But then also at the protests in Georgia, it would often be formatted like Saturday was a mix of music, theater, puppetry, and extremely powerful speakers, including from massacre survivors. And then on Sunday, it would just be a sort of more, almost like a religious service where it feels like being in church in the most positive sense, with the names being sung all day long. And I wonder if you could talk about just how you guys arrived at that format, and whether you got a lot of feedback. I mean, I certainly got a lot of feedback just as a participant from everybody else around me. So many people hearing them say, like, this is just so powerful. Like, you know, why can't we do this kind of, when we have a protest, why can't they always be like this? Why do they have to not be like this?
Well, that very first year that I told you about that I was there, I was given these names, and that had been a part of the ritual before. But there wasn't a lot of music. There wasn't all the other artistry and puppetry then. But as it unfolded, especially as younger people became a part of it and more diverse cultures of people, you know, the puppetistas, people with that art, they came in and said, you know what, we appreciate the music, but we have another art form that we think calls people into the circle and the gathering. And that was the puppets, the huge puppets that represented, you know, they would always have puppet pageantry every year. It was an open call. The week before, anybody who wants to come to this location, we're going to be building puppets, and they would work with the organizing team for the theme of that year so that the puppetry would mirror the main message. For example, on the 20th anniversary of the killing of Jesuits and Selena and Elba, they made 8 huge puppets, and they were the 6 Jesuits and Selena and Elba, and people were on them. People were up on stilts, you know, and so they're using all of that artistry, the power of you know, what people would do with music and integrating those things. So we did that in Georgia. It got bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, people like Pete Seeger came, right? People like the Indigo Girls were with us. People like Bonnie Raitt, who wasn't with us, was supporting us financially and sending us statements of solidarity. Jackson Browne. So we, you know, we had that. And then, you know, we had more diverse music. It's like, you know, we can't just have all these white people music. We need to have the music of other peoples and other genres. And so other voices started to become a part of that. And as when we moved to the border, it was the same thing, right? So then we actually had the last year, 2018, we had the local Mexican grade school, which gave us their school for the entire weekend, where we had workshops and we could go and rest and there was food. Local people were cooking and making food. The school children came and sang and danced on the Mexico side on the stage as a part of the gathering. The puppetistas, there's some beautiful images of, you know, there's the butterflies and hands on the U.S. side of the wall on huge sticks reaching, right? Hundreds of feet in the air, and on the Mexico side and touching and joining each other, and butterflies. So the puppetry became a part of that. I can send you Colleen Katow, who's one of our decades-long musicians, who will be a part of the vigil on November 22nd, along with peace poets and Francisco Herrera and Emma's Revolution. Colleen produced a video, a song that she wrote, "Your Place of Freedom." All of the imagery of it is the border that first year. You see people on both sides of the border. You see you can feel some of the pulse of what's happening that very first year for that bi-national encuentro. So I can send that to you because I think you would appreciate the imagery, the music, and you see the puppetistas as well. So that has remained a part of who we've been in all this time.
Can you talk about I know that you have, I mean, at least just doing even a search of your name on online, religious organizations come up in the search, and there's the movement around the School of the Americas, and so much of the movement for human liberation throughout Latin America over a long time has been wrapped up with liberation theology and with various elements of the Jesuits and the elements of more progressive, more radical elements of the Catholic Church. And I wonder if you can just talk about the background there with your organizing and with SOA Watch in terms of Catholicism and religion. And I mean, for I'm just saying, particularly thinking in terms of some of our viewers here, like who may be, you know, teenage atheist anarchists from Seattle, for example, and how are they viewing that? I mean, it's just, it's not everybody's experience that religion is a radical force for liberation in their lives.
Right. And that's, I appreciate that. That's a good question. The origins of the School of the Americas were definitely Catholic because the Jesuit priests were Catholic. Archbishop Romero was Catholic. The four North American church women, three nuns and a laywoman, were Catholic, right? So many people, the liberation theology within Latin America is why the School of the Americas in part was established, because prior to liberation theology, which is a Catholic theology that says, no, I don't need to suffer here on earth in order to find reward in heaven. I need to be a part of justice on earth. It isn't about, there may be, you know, the belief of Catholics in an afterlife, but the life on earth, we aren't supposed to be suffering here. The systemic racism within the United States and within the world that basically liberates a lot of white people, but not so much people of color and impoverished people, regardless of race. You know, so it's like, okay, liberation theology says you have a right to live fairly and justly. You should not be repressed and oppressed. So in that liberation theology, School of the Americas was like, nope, These liberation theologians, these grassroots people in the countryside, in the cities, they're asking people to be paid fairly, to be treated fairly, to have jobs, to have health care and not die from dirty water. And that was dangerous because so many people were speaking up, and not all of them. It wasn't liberation theology for everybody, but that movement was definitely scary, and it was a wake-up call. And the School of the Americas, which has been around for far too many decades, with far too many tens of thousands of soldiers trained, was to try to repress that liberation. So it started with those 13 people. I can't say for sure, but Kathy Kelly's Catholic, Roy Bourgeois was a Catholic priest. So, and there were other, the other people there, many of them were Catholic. As we grew, when I said before, we were challenged on our white privilege, we were also challenged on the Catholicism. Hey, this is really important what you're talking about. And I'm not a person who has a particular faith in a religion. I have faith in humanity. Where is there room for me? And so that was part of the challenge that we went through for a good 10 years of expanding and listening and changing what we were doing so that the movement is very diverse. There are Catholic people and there's Jewish people and there's Christian people. One of the leadership on our council, Maha, from New York, is Muslim. And so she's helped us to challenge and think about that wider perspective. And there are people who have, belief in humanity, but not in a particular religion. That is part of who we have become.
Yeah. At its peak, the protests, in terms of size, the protests in Georgia, when they were attracting like 15,000 people, I would say that maybe half of those people were people who came in from colleges from around the country, and most of those colleges, maybe half of those colleges, would have been Catholic oriented or based or somewhere along the line, Jesuit colleges. No, it was.
I would say at least a few thousand of them came because of the Jesuits. So there was a lot of Jesuit high school and Jesuit university organizing to come because it was the anniversary always of the killing of the Jesuits and Salina and Elba. What happened? There were a few different things that happened. September 11th, the more recent September 11th, not
1973 and not 1981.
In Chilean September 11th, that's SOA connected as well.
Very much.
Right. So, but the more recent September 11th, which affected the United States, after that September 11th, you could no longer walk into the woods. There was one massive fence, and then there were layers of fence that were there and barbed wire, right? So they were like, oh, no, this is entirely, even though we had decades of a history of being peaceful and nonviolence, hundreds of people arrested and put away for many years, hundreds of years. But they weren't gonna trust that. And so all of these walls went up so that people started to become more afraid because of that. The Jesuits decided that they weren't going to be a part of this anymore and they were going to do something else. I personally think that had something to do with Roy Bourgeois, Marianne priest, who was standing up for women's ordination, which wasn't something very acceptable within the Catholic Church at that time. It still is a challenge now. So there were a lot of different factors why the numbers started to shrink after September 11th and the shifting of the Jesuits bringing thousands of people. And in part, that and knowing that the SOA was training U.S. Border Patrol as well, compelled us to organize differently. And we spent a good 6 months of figuring out where on the border. Was it Texas, Mexico? Was it New Mexico? Was it California? And we ended up choosing Arizona as that binational encuentro because of the work that we knew that was happening on the U.S. and Mexico side of the border and people we were connected to, like no more deaths, no más muertes. And we're They will. Somebody from No More Deaths will be a part of the speaking of the litany on November 22nd, because we have established and grown and continue to learn in those relationships and organizing.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, then and that's an also a very interesting and notable case, I think, right now with this election that's just happened, because we're talking, for anybody that doesn't know, we're talking about an organization that helps people who are trying to cross the border and otherwise might die of thirst or hunger or exposure. And they're being accused on multiple different lawsuits coming from the Justice Department of all sorts of felony charges around harboring refugees and feeding and transporting refugees. And these are lawsuits that were brought by both the Obama and the Trump administration's Justice Department.
Yeah, that's right. And it is illegal to leave water in the desert. It is illegal to feed somebody who is struggling in the desert. That is illegal. And so, yeah, I mean, Scott Walker is the most well-known case, which has come up twice. But there are more raids happening. So there's an area that No More Deaths has, which is an area where migrants know that can be a place where they can find a little bit of respite, right? So if they've been able to cross, and that's become so much more precarious because of this administration. But because No More Deaths and other organizations were filing FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, to try to get more information released, all of a sudden, the FOIA, right? They filed for the FOIA, then their camp's raided. Mm-hmm. So that camp has been raided twice in the last year, and that is not normal.
No,
so
completely political.
That's completely political, and that's against, you know, humanitarian acts of compassion.
And the Border Patrol is going around and poking holes in the water jugs that are left around there.
They are. Yes, they are. And BORTAC, which is a part of the Border Patrol, you know, they rim the entire country. So they're allowed 100 miles within the United States. So go Canada and come down 100 miles. Well, you get into many states and cities. 100 miles in from California, 100 miles in from the East Coast, 100 miles. So Border Patrol is not just active and given free rein on the U.S.-Mexico border. It is the whole perimeter of the United States. And then we saw what happened in Portland, right? That was BORTAC. That was part of ICE and Border Patrol with those repressive measures against the protesters.
Yeah, and anybody who's driven through the Southwest anytime and for many decades now has probably had the bizarre experience of being stopped by the Border Patrol, you know, 100 miles or whatever from the border.
And then to Tucson, you know, and right? North to Phoenix, there's a border checkpoint on the major highway.
Right. And it's like a white check. It's like, you know, you roll down your window, they see you're white, you say a few words, and they don't even look at your passport. They don't ask you if you have a passport. So it's just a bizarre.
Yeah, a small form of resistance. Whenever they ask me that, roll down the window, I said, I'm a citizen of the United States, of the world. I'm a global citizen. Yeah, but what are you? What are, you know, they're looking in the back, and often there's different people in the car. It's not just me, a white person. And I refuse to answer them. So I have to say that SOA Watch shut down that Border Patrol checkpoint twice. So the first year in 2016, we had a massive action that happened as the litany and the presentes was finishing. Hundreds of people went up to that major highway on the road north to Tucson and Phoenix, and they just took the road. They took the entire road. And thinking people would get arrested, you know, fairly soon, and the checkpoint would open back up. But actually, they just allowed people to stay. People stayed and stayed, and they sang. Peace poets were there. Other people were there. They had the chants going, the music going. And finally, it became night. And people decided, well, we've shut this down for these many hours, and they left. So what happened then, I think it was... I'm not sure if it was the next year or 2018, but they anticipated we were going to do the same thing. So the checkpoint was closed.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. We preemptively did that action, but they shut it down for that whole afternoon into the evening because they thought we were coming. How poetic is that?
I love it. Yeah. I remember one protest on Wall Street in 2001 that was like that, where they shut down Wall Street in anticipation for us shutting down Wall Street. But we weren't even going to have enough people to shut down Wall Street. There was like 200 people coming. That was the earlier days of the web. Right. And they were like, oh, it looks like it's going to be big. They have a website, you know. But Chris, the actual, I mean, as you know, as much as it's important to talk about what's going on now and how dire the situation is with the border and with everything else, but the in looking back at the past 20 years, one of the things that's really amazingly notable is how you know, I mean, it's always a combination of different factors, but the School of the Americas is training a lot fewer soldiers from a lot fewer countries in Latin America compared to 20 years ago, right? And that's you know, I mean, to whatever degree that's to the pink tide in Latin America and you know, elections like people like Evo Morales and Hugo Chavez and deciding to not want their soldiers getting trained in how to overthrow their democracies and for them. But it's really been it's been a very positive development over the past 20 years in terms of the reach of the SOA, as much as the U.S. continues to be a nefarious imperial power in the world. It's been that sort of shining a light on that has had a real impact.
Right. So I forgot to finish a thought earlier in this interview, but part of that, David, and I appreciate you coming back to that, is when we closed down the SOA and then it reopened as WINSEC, we realized that trying to get traction with another congressional bill to shut down WINSEC was really, you know, putting ourselves up against the wall. So we strategically, brilliantly, we had a few people working in Latin America, Lisa Sullivan, one of them. And so we just said, you know what? We are going to grow our work in Latin America. So we actually have staff. We have two of our four staff people are in Latin America. You know, Pablo is in Chile and he's a survivor of torture. And Brigitte has been in a variety of countries. She formerly worked with a coalition of Immokalee workers, which we've also had a historic relationship with. And she's between Honduras and Guatemala. Candice has been in Colombia, but COVID bumped her out and she's in California currently. Dev, who also is a directly impacted person, is the person who moved, was living on the border, and that person, our staff person on the border. So we just said, we're going to continue to grow our work in Latin America. So not only with staff, but Roy and Lisa Sullivan and other people as a part of SOA Watch started going from country to country to say, look, we can't shut down the SOA in the U.S., but you can stop sending you can start sending soldiers to be trained at the SOA. And so we actually, Evo Morales, Bolivia, was one of the first countries 10 to 12 years ago to say, yeah, no more. We're not sending those soldiers anymore. So they went directly to the government, to the presidents, to the military, to whomever was there. So at one point in time, we had Bolivia, we had Uruguay, Venezuela, Argentina, Costa Rica, which trains, even though it is a, you know, non-military country, it's police, just like Mexico. There are many of these countries now. Okay, maybe it's not their soldiers, but their police are being trained at the SOA, at WINSEC. So we got countries to start saying no to sending their troops. That grew a lot more notoriety around the work and around what SOA was, and then growing our work in Latin America. So there was an encuentro that happened in Latin America maybe 6 or 7 years ago. And out of that, which was predominantly Latin American activantes, young people who were directly impacted with the work in their own countries, all came together in Venezuela. And they organized, they learned from each other. And from that grew a group with a native name called Abayala, which is the indigenous of the earth. And Abayala is now connected to and organizing with SOA Watch. And it grew out of SOA Watch, but has become its own collective in a variety of countries. So you can see how the work, it isn't just about closing down the SOA. It is the origins of the root of SOA, which have grown and continue to grow this Activante work on both sides of the border.
That's a fantastic little story about how that happened. I didn't know those details. That's wonderful. Chris, you're in Chicago right now, yeah? Where you've been for quite a while. And I wonder if you can, what there's been a lot going on in Chicago, and I don't know how much time, how much you've been getting out physically, or but I know you know a lot of people in Chicago, and regardless, it's always one of those sort of awkward questions during the pandemic. It's like, okay, I don't want to suggest that you're never, you know, that you're ever leaving your apartment, but in case you are. But I mean, it's been, can you talk about what's been happening in Chicago over the past few months? I know that's a huge question, but whatever comes to mind.
It's a huge question. I do get out. You can see the space I'm in is an attic. So you see maps behind me. That's because I teach. I teach global music, which is an anti-racist music program. I teach in right now. I currently am teaching online, but I teach in Little Village, which is a almost 25% COVID, a Latinx community. So a directly impacted community with gorgeous, gorgeous community of teachers and students and their families. Because I teach in communities like that, I teach in many different parts of the city of Chicago. I have been connected, become connected because I'm a musician. I've become connected to so many parts of the city, whether it's Mejente and OCAD, Organized Communities Against Deportation, or Black Lives Matter. So we have, my husband and I, my daughter, we have gotten out to a variety of protests, even, you know, during, before COVID, but of course, since COVID, it's been much more challenging. But there's a lot of powerful organizing that's happening in Chicago, both virtually this way, as well as out in the streets. I had a call this morning from a beautiful young organizer who I met when she was a college student and started bringing people from her university down to Georgia. And, you know, she's years out of college now, but she called me about prison work and the horror of what's happening, especially because of COVID and the repression of people within and how unsafe they are, not to mention the injustice of the criminal justice system. And that's a lot of her work. She called me wanting to talk about how to do ongoing safe action, right? Mm. So there's action, there's so much happening in so many circles. In the immigrant justice circle, I'm a part of a sanctuary working group, which is different communities that are, when people are released from ICE, and we're pressuring that people get released because of, especially because of COVID, not to mention that it's immoral anyways, where are they gonna be? So finding safe places. Safe harbor, communities, people who can support their ongoing work, doing a lot of, because of being at the border, the church community, which I am, Wellington Avenue, United Church of Christ, I'm the music director. Mm. Because of being at the border, when I came home that first year, 2016, somebody working on the Mexico side and another person on the US side called and said, hey, we have two asylum seeking families, Guatemalan and Salvadoran. Who in Chicago could be their sponsors? Well, it turned out that our church became their sponsors and walked with them for 2 years in that asylum process. But we didn't do that alone. We did that because of all of these other congregations and communities that were supporting the work that we were doing. We had to raise $15,000 to bond out the young woman who was separated from her family because she was 19 and considered an adult. And she was put in Eloy Detention Center in Arizona, where we had just been protesting. We protested outside the detention center. So we couldn't do that by ourselves, right? That was a GoFundMe effort because of this large community of people. So before COVID and during COVID, that organizing continues to happen. We just had an immigrant justice benefit concert with an added new powerful voice of Muslim Palestinian communities here in Chicago, who there's a whole nother issue, right, of immigrants and refugees. What's the largest group of refugees throughout the world? I mean, in terms of the longest and the most dispersed, the Palestinians. Mm. So just continuing to learn how we need to come together as diverse communities with similar issues in each of our areas. So that was a Muslim, Latinx, gringa benefit concert that usually has a couple hundred people, but because we were virtual, over 800 people joined us, and that music was in three different languages. So
yeah,
that's virtual powerful organizing. We're also out in the streets. There's a lot of powerful work being done.
But it's been with the pandemic and learning that singing is one of the worst things. I mean, that's just been, it's been hard to cope with just emotionally and like in terms of like tactically, because I mean, as a musician, I always feel like, music is what I have to add to whatever's going on. If I'm going to add anything, probably that's going to be the thing. And then knowing that you can't really go do that, at least not in the physical world, without, you know, potentially endangering people. How have you been adjusting in whatever, in any sense of that term as a choral director in this time? I mean, this just, right. You know, it's kind of like a super spreader profession. It's really
right. So I would say a really good example of that, both in the benefit concert that we just did, El Pueblo Canta is the name of it. It's a 12-year concert that's happened here in Chicago. Both in that and, you know, if you join us on November 22nd for the annual vigil of the School of the Americas Watch, you will see how we're doing it, right? So we've already had one rehearsal. We will have another rehearsal next Monday with all the musicians. They already started just in a Zoom call, put out a song, one person recorded it, another person added to it, and then sent it out to everybody so they can layer it so that the sung response, the litany response, and the presente will actually have many layers. Because you can't sing together in this platform. There's that time lag. But yeah, if you pre-record some things. But what else you will see, David, I think you will appreciate in the spirit of SOA Watch history of embracing music and culture, the arts, is there's going to be some different musicians who will sing, but then there's those, as Pete Seeger would call them, zipper songs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Gonna lay down my sword and shield, and then David, I say down by the riverside. Go ahead.
Down by the riverside.
And it's me. Down by the riverside.
Gonna lay down my sword and shield.
Down by the riverside.
Where is the delay? I'm gonna study war. We do have a delay, though, right? We have a microsecond delay.
But it is a way to be together and sing together. So in that collective.
Yeah, the call and response.
We're doing a little bit of that call. And you can do a call and response. You can have David, you can lead a verse, and then I can lead a verse, and then peace poets can speak a verse. So we've been learning how to do that. And the musicians who are joining us on November 22nd, that's what they've been doing since COVID has shut down. We had SOA Watch had a concert October 17th, which was a binational concert. And all those people and Leilani and Gen Dog Rising, there were other groups that were a part of that who have a history and connection to us. And they, you know, we figured out how to do it so that we can still be together. Even though we can't be together in person, we need to fill each other's spirits. We need to sing together. We need to name the evils together. We need to find compassion together. We need to call each other into accountability and challenge and have that audacious spirit of courage and love, because we have to keep on keeping on. And we can do that. We cannot allow COVID and the horrors of what has not happened to protect people and keep us safe in this country. We need to stand up to that in whatever medium we can, and speak and be and act.
Yeah, whether or not it's difficult, you just you do your best under the circumstances, and that's wonderful. That the call and response thing reminds me of something. I think Pete Seeger often talked about singing at a big march on the Washington Mall, where there's too many people for it to really work without this crazy echo. And so he just, the only thing he could think of to do that would really work was basically a cappella. I think he did Give Peace a Chance, because it was just anything with the guitar was just bouncing all over the place. And it was the, Yeah, that's which is the same kind of thing with the problem with Zoom. Although I've been told that it is possible if you're in the same time zone and something else doing with your computers, and I don't know how it works, but you can get rid of that delay. But I've never figured out how to do it.
Yeah, we haven't figured that out. But there's also people have pre-recorded things. So like in the concert or events that we had another a webinar from our staff in September. We put music into that. So it wasn't just people speaking and questions and answers, but, you know, there was some live music. The Peace Poets are amazing at that. But also we had some pre-recorded videos of different music groups, which could then be a part of an event. So there's a lot of ways to still make that part of an event.
So just switching gears for a moment here. There's a lot of talk of possibility that the president-elect is going to appoint your former mayor Rahm Emanuel as his chief of staff, and I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Not a good choice.
It's really sad, huh? But as a longtime Chicago resident, give us a few more thoughts on that.
Yeah, I did not appreciate his leadership in Chicago. I would say the one positive thing that he did that I can honestly embrace is he greened the city. So there's a lot more trees. There's a lot more bicycles that you can, you know, pick up at different locations and ride in the city. So, you know, the greening piece, he did a decent job of that. But, you know, I do not appreciate or respect so much of the brutality that happened in this city, the repression of people of color, the lack of opportunities for to listen to the collective leadership that was doing grassroots organizing that had new opportunities and solutions. You know, the numbers of Black and brown people, predominantly male and Black, that are killed in the city every week. We are close to 700 people, 700 killed just this year. Okay, that's systemic racism. That is a reality that isn't just about changing the criminal justice system. That's looking at transformative justice and restorative justice to entirely upend and change how we interact. You know, the racism in this city, the West Side, the South Side, depending on where you live and what you deal with, the COVID rates being high in Little Village, which is Latinx, but not as high in my neighborhood, which is a much more mixed neighborhood. Yeah, it's an injustice, and he did not do justice to the reality. So that would be a very sad choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chris and Sarah, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me. It's been very interesting and informative, hopefully for other people as well out there in the world. Oh, there's even somebody commenting. No particular questions from the Peanut Gallery, but thank you so much for joining me for the hour. Yeah. It's been great.
And I'm happy to, if you want, I can follow up and send you a few links.
Oh, yeah. And most especially SOAW.org, where people can attend and or find out how to attend the upcoming
November
online.
21st and 22nd. Yeah. If you go to SOAW.org, that information will be up there soon. But if you go there right now, you will see a lot of the work that we're doing on both sides of the border.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, Chris. Take care.
You too.
And thanks, everybody, for joining in on this discussion with Chris and Sarah, a fantastic choir director, organizer, musician from Chicago, Illinois, and very much for a long time involved with organizing the protests in Georgia and at the border against the School of the Assassins, the School of the Americas. Once again, find out more at SOAW.org about the upcoming online vigil in about 10 days from now. And thanks, everybody, for joining in. You can find this archived on my YouTube channel and on my Facebook page and Twitter, VK, LinkedIn, Twitch, and also on the Facebook pages of KBOO Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon, and on Popular Resistance's Facebook page, and also in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovics wherever you get your podcasts. I'll be back with another interview on Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, and then also at the end of the month, on the last Saturday of the month at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern this month and every month, I'll be doing a concert from the living room here in Portland, Oregon. And thanks again. Remember, don't pay the rent. Mutual aid will get us through. Trust your neighbors. Take care. Bye for now.